Welcome, this is Matthew Bronson, and this is Conversations with Matthew Bronson here on KUPR 99.9 FM in the high desert of Placitas, New Mexico. And today on Conversations, we are speaking with Joe Feldman, local, can we call you playwright?
Yes.
Director?
Yes.
All of that?
Yes, and more.
And more, and we will get to that. So right now, we kind of got you on the program because you are working with our friends at Adobe Theater.
Correct.
And you have a play coming up.
I do.
And that play is?
The Best Man. And it's not about a wedding.
Okay.
It's about the best man for the job. It's a political thriller written by Gore Vidal, wonderful writer. And it's an excellent piece of work. Very exciting.
Sometimes I've been called a piece of work, and I think they meant it differently.
I can see that, actually, you know.
Having spent an hour with me?
Yes, it's all quite plain.
Why did you pick that particular piece at this particular time?
Well, in fact, I didn't pick it. It was offered to me by a good friend of mine, Jim Cady, over at the Adobe, and he thought I might like to do it, and I read it and just flipped. I think it's some of the best stage writing I've ever read. Excuse me, Mr. Shakespeare. And it is so appropriate to the time we're living in right now in terms of the political environment. I know we have to be a little careful as we discuss that.
Certainly.
That's right. Totally bipartisan show here.
Absolutely. But I've always described it, and I don't think this is getting too edgy, but it's almost like the best reality show in the last decade, except it really is for real.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, if you are politically aware, it gets you more energized. So even a lot of people criticize that, this is not good and that's not good. But I think huge increase in voter turnout and involvement in the process by younger people, that's all good stuff. And
that's
kind of like what the play's about.
Yeah, definitely. Well, the play really kind of hinges on an exploration of those people who quest for power at the highest levels. What does it take to be the best man for that kind of a job? And the play does not necessarily give you any concrete answers that you can walk away from. Oh, I got it now. It's very ambiguous about the characters and the qualities that they have. And it's a play that will make you think quite a bit.
Oh, that's low on my list
I'm
of
sorry.
Thinking.
I'm sorry.
I just don't do it very well. The play is about getting the best man or woman for that job.
Correct.
Was the play written most recently enough that they even consider women or minorities as a possible candidate?
Interestingly, the play originally debuted in Broadway around 1960 when it was first written. But in a recent revival, James Earl Jones was cast as the ex-president. So in that production, they tended to update things or make things possible that, we certainly have our current president.
Certainly.
But when that production was done, I don't believe he was in office.
And do you think, as a director, that it would make any difference in your production?
I've thought a lot about that in the course of getting prepared to do the play. Mm-hmm. And I consciously decided that I didn't want to do something other than what the author had created. It just worked so well.
I bet authors appreciate a director doing that.
Yeah, even from beyond the grave where he is now. But it just was such a jewel box of a play. It's like a Swiss watch, all these moving pieces come together just beautifully, and the characters are so fantastically and finely etched. And it is sort of a period, but it's also very universal. I mean, it's so applicable today. It's about two candidates for the same party,
right,
who are vying for that party's nomination to run for president. And so it doesn't get into...
Only two, not 12?
Well, no. At this point, there's only two. Back in 1960, when things were a little less volatile.
Yes.
But it's fascinating because you seem to suspect that it's a black hat, white hat kind of story, but it's really not. I mean, everybody's sort of drenched in blood, if that's not too sanguine a thing to say about it.
Right. Well, and when you say the best man, does the author define what that is? What makes someone the best?
Well,
because we've seen, I think sometimes it's who does the best job at campaigning. You know, it's marketing,
mm-hmm.
and so who becomes the most popular?
That's correct. The author does delineate a lot of ideas about what constitutes a best man, but do all of those qualities exist in one person? What happens if you have, in this example, in this play, two characters who have some of the qualities but not others?
Right.
What then constitutes the best man?
Yes. I mean, that. I guess that's a decision that every voter makes.
Correct.
And does that come into play also, that different people are looking for different things?
Yes. Yes. How do I put this? The play is really largely overseen by this ex-president character, the one who James Earl Jones played on right. Broadway. And he seems to be the paradigm, yet he is this farm boy from the rural sticks who happened to see a William Jennings Bryan speech out on an old dray in a field and inspired right. him to go into politics. And he says, I decided I was going to go into politics and I was going to eat a lot of fried chicken and barbecue and have all the pretty girls hanging on my words. And he is the apotheosis, in a way, of what you might wish for
right.
in a great politician, but he will cut your throat in a second if you get in his way.
Is this about Lyndon Johnson? I understand he was a very persuasive president.
Oh, yes. I you've probably seen that famous picture of him leaning over some senator who's, you know, about right. a head shorter than he is. The guy's, you know, blown right. back.
It sounds like you're almost describing someone who wants a career path of a rock and roll star of the 70s and 80s. He wants to be able to eat and party and have girls and be famous. And
well, you know, Henry Kissinger famously said, power is the greatest aphrodisiac.
Yes, I believe that was a discussion about going to China with President Nixon.
That's right. And
I watched way too much public broadcasting when I was young. If there's such a thing as too much public broadcasting.
Ditto. But I think that character, ex-president Hochstetter, was based on Harry Truman.
Right.
And one of the characters in the play is based on Bobby Kennedy, another on Adlai Stevenson. So they're not literal bios of these folks, but
certainly.
But the author took from real life, you know, some of the more fascinating politicians of the day. But I'm not sure I can really do the justice to it, even though I'm the director.
Right.
It is such a, like I said before, a Swiss watch of all these moving parts. You sort of are mesmerized by all of the different characters and all the different turns that the plot takes. It's labyrinthine, like the labyrinth you have out here.
Yes. All right, so a director.
Yes.
You grew up on the East Coast.
Right.
And did you, well, what was your geographical route from New York to the Albuquerque area?
Let's see. My mom and dad, unlike virtually every other Jewish family in New York, did not want to go to Florida to retire.
Wow.
Yeah, even though there's that Wolfie's famous delicatessen there in Miami Beach. They somehow found New Mexico, which back in 1970 was not particularly well known. In fact, you know, we had family members say to us, why are you moving out of the country? What's the matter with you?
Well, I mean, as you know, and we've kind of kidded about in the past, being an East Coast guy, and when we moved, it was, you know, there's the East Coast, New York, Atlanta, all that stuff.
Right.
Then you kind of get to Chicago, and then you get to Texas, and then you hit California, and there's that big gap in the center. You might stop at Las Vegas, Nevada, but it totally unknown. Why are you moving someplace to the desert? So brown.
Right.
It's like, it doesn't look so brown to me.
No.
So why did they do that?
I never really knew. They just said, well,
but it wasn't for a job. It was to retire.
No, yeah, they'd retired, and I was going off to college, and so they came out here, and I fell in love with it immediately. And it was so different than New York. I mean, the landscape, the precipitation, everything about it was...
The population density.
Yes,
there's the courteousness. Right. Although I find, for the most part, people in Manhattan are...
Oh, yeah.
They're pretty nice.
They are, really, truly.
They're just in a hurry.
Yeah. You got to watch out for those ladies with the strollers, too.
Oh,
they're,
yes.
They're dangerous.
With twins.
Yeah, bumper cars, like.
Yeah.
But
what did they move to Albuquerque or to Corrales? Or?
They moved to, they were going to move to Rio Rancho, which at that time was a motel and a golf course.
I was
going to
say, six houses.
Yeah. But they ended up in Paradise Hills, which sounds like a... place to spend eternity.
Yes, and, it does.
But you know, I had a fantastic experience when we first moved here. My cousin Fran, who is or was the director of the Palace of the Governors and the New Mexico History Museum up in Santa Fe, archaeologist, she asked me if I'd like to spend the summer with her on an archaeological field survey. And we spent, I think, a month living at Zuni and then down Apache Reservation,
right,
a little further south, and some power company was putting in a power line 330 feet wide,
right,
and we were a small team and we walked it,
sure,
like a couple hundred miles looking for archaeological sites, and if we found one we would map it and take a surface collection. And I was just in clover. We had to ride horses in some places, mm-hmm, and be brought in by helicopter to other places. There was this guy, we used to call him Larry America.
Okay.
And I'm Larry, you know, and he was the helicopter driver, and he used to love to do things like turn the helicopter on its side. You know, they got no doors.
Sure.
So, you know, Larry.
When you were walking the tribal land, did they kind of coach you on this is what... relics look like?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you would see that there would be potsherds and manos and matatas laying around. Sometimes, I found my first arrowhead. That was one of the highlights of my life.
Right.
It's a beautiful thing. As thin as a piece of paper made out of a kind of a white quartzish, right, material.
See what you can do when you don't have cable TV and internet?
Oh, I know.
You can,
yeah,
accomplish a lot.
That's right. And
well, did you... You didn't get to keep them. Did
no,
you?
No, no, no.
Did you have to mark that spot as a spot not to be disturbed?
Yes, yes. They would map it on a big map,
right,
the site, and that permitted the people who were putting in the power towers to know where they could not put one of those big, massive concrete blocks,
sure,
that the tower would be on. And also the dunes would drift,
okay,
you know, from the weight of the tower.
Mm-hmm.
So I imagine in some places it created quite a complex problem, engineering problem for them to solve with that. But we came across some sites that were really extensive. I mean, acres. But the whatever was there, you know, the pueblos have been buried by sand.
Oh, certainly.
And dunes. It was just amazing for this, you know, Jewish kid from New York who...
for anybody.
Anybody, yeah. It was great, great introduction, yeah, to New Mexico.
I guess. I mean, that people would probably pay a lot of money to be able to do that. So after that, what did you do?
Well, I went off to college. I went to school in Iowa, which was also quite interesting. I loved the Midwest.
But what drew you to that college? I mean, you probably hadn't spent a lot of time in Iowa previously.
No, our next door neighbors in New York had both gone to this school.
Right.
And they mentioned it to my mom and dad, and so I applied. And I went out there as a prospective to visit, you know.
Right.
And they had at that time sit-down dining, where you'd go into the dining hall and they'd serve you a meal.
Right.
And so I was sitting there eating this meal, and there was something weird about, it was like a kind of stew, but the meat was all fat and gristle. And
I hear spam coming on here.
Well, what eventually happened was the room started to rumble, and this guy comes up and says, well, I want you to know that Saga Food Services serves nothing but the finest USDA. And before he could get that out, you know, big chunk of something went flying through the air, and before I knew it, there was food raining.
Food fight.
Every place. Big food fight, and I'm hunkered down saying, I'm going to school right here.
That was a positive for you.
Yes, it was. It was.
Did the school have a particular course of study that appealed to you?
No, it was liberal arts college, you know, and I was, at the time I was thinking I was going to be a concert pianist. And I'd done a lot of theater up to that point, but that was sort of in my mind when I got there. And I was spending a lot of time in the practice rooms, windowless little practice rooms. And after a couple of years, I was reading this book by James Michener, where it mentioned something called child ballads. And these are, in the book anyway, they're ballads from England, Ireland, and Scotland, you know, from olden times.
Certainly.
And I thought it was fiction. And then I came to find that it was actually real.
Wow.
And I started getting interested in folk music, American folk music, and European folk music. I picked up the banjo, stopped playing the piano, and did my senior recital on the banjo, and I directed a choir, a Sacred Harp choir, shape note singing. I don't know if you know what that is.
Absolutely not.
Okay. Would you like to know?
Sure, I
okay,
would.
I'll tell you. I think it was in the 1700s in New England. This style evolved where the notes on the staff were geometric shapes, squares and circles and diamonds, and school or music masters would go from town to town, village to village, and teach people to read music and sing hymns with this system. And each one had a like fa, sol, la, ti, do.
Right.
And so they would sing and go fa, la, la, sol, mi, to, and through the
syllables. Based upon the geometric shapes.
Right. And then they would be able to sing the actual words to the hymn. And it still exists today.
This sounds like the original Guitar Hero.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Wow. I wonder if that's where it came from.
Well, could be. You never know. Most of it is the most beautiful music. You would be amazed. And in fact, one day when I was at school in Iowa, I had my dog with me, and there's a knock at the door. I opened this guy in overalls, and he says, "Are you Joe Feldman?" And I'm, "Oh, God, what did my dog do?" And I said, "Yeah." And he sticks out his head and goes, I'm John Smith from the Primitive Baptist Church here outside of the town. And we understand you have a shape note choir. And we sing shape note. We want to invite you to come to sing with us." So a whole bunch of us went down one Sunday, and we got to be real good friends with him and his father, who was the pastor. And we used to go to their house for Sunday dinner, very simple dinner, and he'd pull out the Baptist hymnals, primitive right. Baptist hymnals, and we sit and sing all afternoon.
No, no food fight at his house.
No food fight.
Okay.
No,
you contained yourself.
It was way too good, way too good food, and I'll never forget sitting there and again this little just Jewish kid from New York, and I'm going through the hymnal after we'd finished one song, and I said, "Hey, this one looks really good. Let's sing that one." And the minister put his hand on my hand and said, "Joe, that's what it's all about. Let's sing."
Okay.
There we go.
Praise.
Yeah, praise, praise. So back to my peripatetic life.
But and also, you seem to be making, to me, unusual choices. You obviously have a good, solid background in music, if you were possibly going to have that as a career.
Mm-hmm.
But then you go to banjo,
mm-hmm.
which many people love. Other than maybe Ricky Skaggs, I don't get it. I mean, I love all kinds of music. And banjo's okay, but I don't think... it's something I would use to express myself with. I think I'd pick another instrument, like maybe a piano.
Oh, wow, that's a yeah. ridiculous idea.
And then you're learning with traditional music notation, you know, this five-line staff with notes and quarter notes and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then you go back to a totally different system, 400 years old. Is that... tell us anything about Joe Feldman?
Well, that he's deeply disturbed is perhaps the most salient factor. You know, I've always thought of my life as a hound on a scent. It's always how it's been to me. I get an interest up in something, and I just do it till I, you know, practically drop dead, and then I get another scent, right. and I go off on that one.
Somehow you've managed to keep a roof over your head and food in your belly through all of these, what you wouldn't call a traditional career path.
Oh, well, that's thanks to my criminal activities.
Okay.
I've been very successful in that regard. And
Oh, you're in politics?
I hope not.
No. Well, we all are to some extent. And we all should be, because
yes,
it's our
right,
country.
That's right.
On your journey to
the Albuquerque area, but mm-hmm. where was your next stop?
Well, after I graduated from school, I was fortunate enough to be selected as an intern at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis. I graduated from college with one degree in music and one degree in theater, and had done a lot of theater while I was in school. And while I was in Minneapolis, and at that point I was thinking more in terms of a career in the theater, I decided that I was going to take a winter workshop at a dance company. Minneapolis was a big, big dance town.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and this was a modern dance company, Nancy Hauser Dance Company and School, and it was a workshop for beginners like me, and...
Is that like Arthur Murray? Is it kind of a cliche? Should I know her?
And I'm no, just probably not.
Okay.
But at the end of the workshop, I stopped doing theater entirely and devoted myself entirely to dance. I was so captivated by it, captivated by her. You know, many people know who Isadora Duncan is.
Yes.
She's sort of the mother of, one of the mothers of modern dance.
More so than the Hauser Dance School.
Well, actually, there was a woman in Germany who, Mary Wigman was her name, who created her own school out of the Bauhaus tradition. And one of her students, named Hanya Holm, was tasked with coming to America. This is around the just after the turn of the century, to bring the ideas, the modern dance ideas from the German school here. And Nancy Hauser, my teacher, was in Hanya Holm's company.
Okay.
So she really got it from the horse's mouth. I'm sorry, Hanya. But I was fortunate enough to, for 3 summers, I got full scholarships to study with Hanya in Colorado Springs, where she held this annual summer dance workshop. And I would say that probably nothing has more informed my directing than the work I did there. I learned so much about movement and space and time. The three principles of this school of thought is space, time, and energy.
Okay.
All movement is based on space, time, and energy. A certain amount of time elapses in which a movement happens. A movement occupies space. It travels through space, and it carries energy.
Right.
And from those simple ideas, this entire edifice is created, which her modern dance was made.
And is it, when I think of modern dance, I think of like Alvin Ailey.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of dance that, did it originate in Germany, or that there was just someone really good at it there that came to America?
Well, there is now so many different companies and so many different branches of modern dance that in one sense are all related because it all has to do with movement.
Right.
But their origins and the traditions they come from, and they all interrelate. You know, like in America we have Martha Graham, for example. She's probably the best known classic modern dancer we have.
Yes.
But many of her students went out and created their own schools of dance, and it's wonderful because each generation tries to find, just like with music or theater, anything, any kind of art, you know, if you go from medieval painting to, you know, eventually there's Picasso and then
right.
and Jeff Koons. So it's always evolving and interrelated.
And how old were you when you were doing this?
Let's see, I guess I was about 23 when I started dancing.
So, because I asked that because for the folks listening on KUPR.org, as opposed to ABQLive.tv, where they can see the amazing shape that we're both in.
Oh, yes, yes.
So we have the typical over 50 male body.
Sort of like bowling pins.
Yes. So at this point, you're not actively modern dancing.
No.
So was that a real, besides the technique and the dance moves, was there also a lot of time in the gym, almost like a gymnast, to be able to perform all those? I mean, it's almost like the Olympic floor exercises that you see, some of the modern dance, or some of the Cirque du Soleil. I mean, they are incredible athletes as well
as
artists.
Right.
So did you look like that?
Yes.
Really?
I did. This is getting depressing.
No, what happened?
Change the subject. Well,
I was never an athlete. So
that's I got to get something on you, I'm telling you.
Is it like a boxer or a professional sports person where it's a limited career, you just get too old to do it?
Yeah. Yeah, you do. I mean, things start to wear out fairly quickly, especially your
You're
knees.
You're telling me.
Your knees and your hips.
Right.
They're the first to go. But it's like any physical discipline. You know, each discipline is unique to itself. I used to do some boxing, and so I understand what that's all about. And same thing in dance. You have different techniques that you can study. I used to take ballet classes and other different styles, martial arts and things like that. But all of it is to get you to, what's the best way for me to put this? At least in our school of dance, it was all about creating kinesthetic awareness of your body and movement. And being physically fit and being, flexible and all that is just a part of it, a really very small part of it, because we haven't even really touched on choreography and what it is to create dances and how that all comes together. So you're tuning up your instrument every day you go to class. You know, sometimes people take 2, 3, 4 classes a day.
Right.
Different kinds of things, improvisation, choreography. And yes, you strengthen and tune up your instrument, but at the end of the day, you got to do something with it. You know,
sure.
You're trying to make a Stradivarius out of yourself, but then you have to play it. And to this day, it informs everything that I do when I move. It's just something that gets into you.
Do you think you? I mean, you look healthy.
Oh, don't get carried away.
Well, I mean, relatively speaking, compared to me. Do you think that having that semi-athletic life, intense athletic life, for a lot of your life, does that make your post-50, well, you're like 62, do you think that you've reaped the benefits of having that lifestyle?
Definitely. Definitely. Well, it's a mixed bag because, as I said, you wear parts out, and you'll see a lot of ex-dancers with, canes and replacement knees and things like that.
I thought the cane was an affectation.
That's right. We all want to be Fred Astaire.
Yes. I want to be Bette Masterson.
Oh, yeah. I love that. What was that actor's name?
Gene.
That's right.
Barry.
Thank you.
Nice Jewish boy, too.
That's right.
Well, do you, as a, I'll just call it a former athlete, is that part of your routine now, or do you integrate the importance of remaining flexible at this point, or have you given up like the rest of us, meaning me?
Well, I'm certainly not as flexible as I used to be, when I was stretching every day. But as I was saying a moment ago, it's more like a mindset. It's like the tip of this little finger knows what my little toe is doing. I know it sounds kind of arcane and mystical and silly, but it's really true. It's like this conscious awareness of how your body is moving and operating every moment. And so when I walk around, I can't stop doing it. I don't sit there and go, okay, here's gravity affecting me this way, and there's this foot and this foot and this foot. But I'm aware in a certain kind of way. But in terms of physical stuff, I, for many years, have practiced Tai Chi because that is a very similar sort of practice to this. It's, I'm no sort of expert on
the, right. The, but it is a choreography. It is a set combination of movements.
Correct.
And I think it tells a story. Or?
No, it doesn't tell a story. It's there are different forms of Tai Chi, different styles, so you can...
I like Earl Grey, personally. I tried it a few times.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is remarkable for what you would consider relatively minimal amount of physical exertion, the physical benefits, kind of like Pilates,
mm-hmm.
where you're not lifting a 300-pound barbell, you're using your body,
right,
and you get into incredible shape that way.
Oh yeah, well, dancers do a lot of stretching, and they get their strength more so from stretching muscles than where you pump iron and muscles contract. That's right. Why you see these bodybuilders and they can hardly, you know, hardly move.
Right.
I think the thing about Tai Chi, you know, it comes from, it's a form of martial arts. So these movements are actually defensive maneuvers, moving fists and legs that are coming right at you out of the way, or punches and kicks of their own. But really, I think the thing that benefits people the most, again, is that kinesthetic sense. You're pulling your whole body together, and you feel this holistic energy just all the way through you, as new agey as that sounds.
And I guess it depends what part of the world you're seeing people who are practicing Tai Chi, but it's often in groups.
Mm-hmm.
And is that part of the philosophy, that it's a group thing, or is it more of I know you can do it individually.
Yeah,
but
I don't know the answer to that. I think that... when I've done it in groups, it's just it's almost communing. You know, you sense the other people around you, and it feels a much more intense experience.
To some extent, it's almost like a school of fish, the small ones.
Mm, yeah.
If you ever snorkel or whatever, they move in unison, or birds, flocks of birds. It's crazy.
Oh, I know.
I mean, I don't think we're insulting them by saying they're not the brightest animals on the planet, yet they're so in tune to each other, and they know what to do to attack, and they know what to do for defense.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the birds do.
Yeah, so. Yeah, definitely.
Marvelous planet. Now, being out here in the Albuquerque area, do you take advantage of all the outdoor stuff, hiking and trail biking and skiing?
Well, I suppose I could, but, jelly donuts and TV is ever so much more appealing than that.
It is. But as a former dancer, weren't you... Back then, was diet nutrition something that your teachers or coaches talked to you about? Or you just... Everybody knew cheeseburgers were bad.
Pretty much everybody I knew smoked.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
All kinds of stuff.
Yeah, definitely all kinds of stuff. And I think, you know, when you're burning so many calories, you're really just, you know, you're hungry and you eat what you want to eat. But I don't know. Back in... I guess this is like around 1977. The whole nutrition craze was sort of absent in at least my life or people I knew.
Tobacco through history is, to me, is fascinating. I don't think there was necessarily the health concern during the Old West, you know, with the pioneers or whatever, but you, and this could just be Hollywood, I don't know, but, you know, you go out on the wagon train, or you're just going from Kansas City to some other city west of that. It's going to take you a month. Well, you've got your flour, and you got your fat back, and you got your beans, and your chaw tobacco.
Right.
That is an essential part of survival. At least that's the way the media makes it look. And it probably was,
mm-hmm,
to some extent. Because wasn't it tobacco used to trade?
Oh, sure. Yeah, definitely.
That's nutty. So you're now, where was your first city of residence in New Mexico?
Well, let's see. You know, after I went off to college, my folks were here. I'd come back frequently and visit them and things like that, but I never really lived here full-time until I got married about 16 years ago, 17 years ago. And I was living in Manhattan at the time, and my wife-to-be was living in Atlanta with her three kids. And well, geez, we can't afford Manhattan with five people.
And were these like school-age children?
The youngest at that time was about four, and the oldest was about nine.
Right. So this was going to be a financial consideration as to where you lived.
Yes.
It wasn't like, oh, they're going off to college. Go get a job.
Right. I'd lived in Atlanta before, and I didn't really want to go back. And I said, you know, I know this great little village in New Mexico called Corrales. And we both flew out and met in Albuquerque and got an agent and drove around Corrales and found a house, and it was for sale, and we bought it.
So you were having a long distance courtship,
mm-hmm,
And then you decided to get married,
mm-hmm.
and you both left your respective East Coast major cities
mm-hmm.
for Corrales. Had your bride-to-be been to Corrales before?
No.
How much of the decision was on her part because that's where her in-laws were going to be and built-in babysitters?
Well, actually, you know, I mentioned earlier that I was quite disturbed, and I think it's probably true for her too. At that point, both my folks had passed away, so there were no in-laws, and I don't know. You know, she's English, and I'm always.
What's the difference between being English and British? Or is it semantics?
I'm going to get hell for not knowing how to answer that question when I get home.
We can pause and Google it.
No, please. But I'll tell you, I've said this in the past when people ask about, you know, what it's like to, you know, be married to someone from England. I'll just move into the England thing. And the first time we had an argument, because, you know, there's all different kinds of words and phrases that the English use that we don't have.
Right.
And the first time Colleen and I got into an argument, she looked at me with these steely eyes and she said, "If you're not careful, I'm going to damage your wedding tackle." And I wasn't...
I figured out immediately what that means.
Yeah, I wasn't sure, but I slept on my stomach for a month, yes. You know, just to make sure. So there is a... What's that?
Now, is that universal? If I meet someone... If I go to England
mm-hmm.
and... with the proper supervision, ask them, what's my wedding tackle? They will know?
Yes, I think they probably will.
Okay. I might get slapped, depending on who I ask.
Yeah.
Well, really? Okay.
Yeah.
So that's not like language differences, like queuing up or fries versus chips or mm-hmm. biscuits versus cookies. This is uniquely British.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And
but Colleen sounds like a nice Irish girl.
Well, actually, she is. Her mother and father emigrated from Ireland to England, and her
Isn't
mother...
Isn't that like a half-hour drive?
I mean, it was a little bit longer okay. than half an hour.
This sounds funny when you say immigrated. It's like a New Mexican immigrating to Arizona.
Well, the Irish are an interesting people.
Yes, they are.
But her mother was like something out of an O'Neill play. Just this force of nature. I loved her to death, Maureen. And, oh, my gosh, begorra, you know, that kind of thing. One of the things I love about the English is they are such language mavens. And they have all of these wonderful ways of rendering the language. Gosh, I wish she was here because she could do it. I can't do it at all. Like this thing they have called rhyming slang.
Okay.
Apples and pears somehow means like up the stairs. I know. I never get it.
No.
And I think I told you we had these nephew and niece come to visit us.
Right.
And they're all doing this rhyming slang, and I'm just not getting any of it. How does it? And they're oh yes.
Well, and that's historic as opposed to like bebop or hip hop that. We have now?
I imagine there's probably a time when it didn't exist. I mean, if you go back far
right.
enough.
But it's been around longer yeah, than hip-hop.
Right, some of right. Those. I think it's probably 50, 100 years old, maybe even right. more. But
somebody famous said that, you know, the British and the Americans are great people separated by...
Common language. Right. I think that was Franklin. Benjamin Franklin said that, maybe. But it's true. The funny thing, though, about England, to me, is... The bathrooms are really small.
Really?
Oh, yes, yes. Okay.
And so after you learned English mm-hmm. or British, at some point you started in the theater business.
Well, after I moved from Minneapolis, I continued to dance, but I moved to Atlanta and was doing more acting again. And I had an opportunity, was given an opportunity to direct. And I had a certain kind of epiphany while I was there. Well,
why would someone ask a dancer to do directing?
Because they're not thinking clearly.
Okay. just one of those things.
Just one of those things, yeah. Right. But I was given this opportunity, and I realized I could synthesize the three main rivers of my life. My musical background, my movement background and my theatrical background, because all of those things play into what a director needs in order to be, I think, be a good director. And so then I pretty much just trundled on in that direction for the rest of my life, although continuing to make music and to do movement. I really kind of stopped doing dancing maybe about 15 years ago. So
it's fascinating to me, and I guess encouraging, that you were able, or that anybody is able, to create a income stream to stay alive. I mean, you didn't have to like wait tables at night or paint during the summer.
No, of course I did.
Oh, did you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I think...
Oh, well, then it's not so wonderful.
No, it's terrible. In my entire life, I probably made less than $10,000 from performing arts.
Total. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so did you also have like a other real job, or you just got jobs as you needed them to survive?
Well, do you remember on Saturday Night Live?
Yes.
Garrett Morris had this character, this... Puerto Rican baseball player.
Yes.
And he would say, baseball been very, very good to me.
Yes. You played baseball?
No.
Okay.
Well, I did when I was a kid. But my dad taught me a little bit about investing in the stock market when I was young. And I got lucky. Mm-hmm. And it turns out the stock market been very, very good to me.
Okay. So and you were wise enough to not get the big house and the big car. You used it as a tool.
Well, you know, as you can tell, I've been peripatetic all my whole life, really, until I married Colleen and we came here. And so I never...
Marriage has a way of calming us men down.
Oh, it does. to a catatonic state, actually.
But that's a survival skill.
That's right. But I you know, was able to save up pretty much everything that I made that way, because I didn't spend it on much more than books and music and driving around in my car, at least take right. road trips.
And obviously Colleen, your wife of 16 years now, knew the gravy train she was marrying into.
Oh, but she only had it to take back, I suppose.
Well, that's love.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But, you know, I was a bachelor till I was 46.
Okay.
When we met. And so I didn't have much to spend on, and I had, you know, saved it up, and so it was great. It worked out well for everybody.
I have a cousin who grew up and lived in Manhattan, or one of the boroughs, got married at 50.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, he did it in July in New York, outside, black tie.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, thank you, cousin Michael.
Really?
Yeah. Well, what can we say about Joe Feldman as a director that, because I'm one of those people that go to theater mm-hmm. or movie, and people go, oh, well, that's a so-and-so directed it. I go, I don't know who that is. I just like the movie. I mean, I do know, you know, obviously, you know, Spielberg, you know, Tarantino. They have very unique styles. But would I look at it and people go, oh, that's a Joe Feldman production?
Well, probably you might be able to. I mean, I think there are, how do I put this? Probably for a lot of stage directors, they'd say they're drawn to a broad variety of material. You know, they're drawn some to classic things, you know, Shakespeare or other classics, international theater,
right.
comedies, dramas. And I think directors develop a style. Like, my style has always been exceedingly theatrical. You know, I like, not so much in terms of spectacle, but I love the fact that it's live. That there are people right there, there's no retakes, you know, if something goes wrong, you got to figure it out, you're creating right. this illusion.
But like we were talking about live radio
right.
versus
right.
recorded.
Yeah.
It takes, you know, it takes a little bit of that zing out of it.
It does.
Although, I do just as well taped.
But, you know, we're in the theater, we're kind of sorcerers, wizards, mm. you know, we're creating these illusions. And it's magic. And so that to me is the theatricality of it. And with just, you know, my dad has a hat, let's put on a play, you know, humble beginnings.
It's like the old Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland movies, where
I mean, you know, nowadays in Broadway, I guess the theater capital of America, there is so much money there to be made, and the spectacle, like the whole Spider-Man thing, for example,
sure,
you know, where they got a flying around and all that. If you got all that kind of money and you can create that sort of spectacle, that's, I guess it's okay. But, you know, on the smaller scale, where you don't have that kind of money and you have to use your creativity and what limited resources you have, because everybody in the theater is poor and every theater is poor and hanging on by a thread.
Right.
It's that's too is kind of magical, how you can get people like this on the edge of their seats or crying or laughing their heads off.
And I assume you have worked in larger venues than the Adobe Theater. Mm-hmm. Do you like one more than the other?
I definitely prefer smaller venues, mm-hmm. The intimacy and the immediacy. Right. Where
now, a few weeks ago or months ago, I guess it depends on when you're listening to this.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been years ago. I interviewed Joseph, the gentleman who wrote The Gavones of Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah.
And I apologize, I don't remember his last name, but he was a great interview. He wrote it.
Right.
And it's being performed at the Adobe Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And he was telling me that most directors do not want the playwright there. How do you feel? Well, you can't have the playwright at this one because he's no longer living.
Correct. Well, I've had great experiences working with playwrights, particularly new playwrights.
Right.
And I've had great experiences working in the absence of a playwright. So I can come down on either side of it. I've been fortunate, though, that most of the playwrights I've worked with have given me a lot of freedom to, you know, to direct as I wanted to. I can imagine you can get someone who is, you know, a real pain in the neck.
Well, do they have the right to say, you can't do that way? That's my play. And
I imagine they could structure the contract in such a way, but you probably will chase a lot of good directors away,
right.
You know.
So what's next for Joe Feldman?
Well, I thought I'd go home and get some lunch.
All right. A green chili cheeseburger or a breakfast burrito?
Maybe both.
Okay. You're still at fighting weight. Do you have aspirations of Broadway?
I think probably everybody says, well, I'd like to be at the, you know, the top of my game, whatever my game is.
I want to win Lotto. I want it the easy way.
I've come to a kind of a point in my career with I love what I do, mm-hmm. and I'm very content. There's a lot of great folks here in Albuquerque, a lot of great actors and technicians, and it's a wonderful family that gets together. And it's amazing how intense the connections happen. Like with the play I'm doing right now, I've never worked with most of the actors in. I've got 12 actors. I've only worked with two before. And but already we're like you know, having sleepovers and things like that.
Okay,
well, maybe
I won't explore that
quite that far. But no, already it feels like kinship,
right?
And it's an amazing thing when a group of strangers kind of come together, all with the same purpose to try to make, you know, the best possible show out of this material. And make all manner of sacrifices of their time and their energy and their emotions, and put so much into it for $0.
Right.
It's a beautiful thing.
Now, you have a history of being a performing dancer.
Yep.
Have you ever thought about putting on the grease paint and becoming an actor, as opposed to, do they still use grease paint? Probably not. But being an actor versus a director.
Well, you know, that's I acted extensively over the course of my career. I've probably been in 50, 60 shows easily as an actor. But I think I've gotten more shy as I've gotten older, and I sort of relish being behind the scenes and kind of
you don't want that notoriety man. That, oh, there goes Joe Feldman.
I'd be willing to try it. You know,
okay.
We could see how that
Well, some
would
people
go.
Don't want any of that.
No, I
Some people
know.
Want to be the rock star, like we talked about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, everybody likes praise, and I like praise, too. I like to hear people say, oh, I saw your show. You know, it was great. Oh, in fact, this is pat myself on the back for this one. I was out with some friends a few years ago. We were having some food, and the waitress was serving the food, and we were talking about theater, and we're talking about a show that I had done, and she goes, "Oh, did you direct that play? I saw that play. That was the best play ever." And boy, I was like the hero of the table, you know, like I got recognized. I think the only time that ever happened to me, though. So
it's better once than never.
Yes, that's so right.
I think we've kind of covered everything, not necessarily in a straight line, but probably more than you thought you were going to be talking about today. Well, then I'm going to wrap it up.
Okay. Thank you very much. It's been a fun time.
Joe Feldman, been around here. Well, your family's been out here for a long time. Oh, yeah. You've been out here close to 20 years.
Right.
And you're currently actively directing.
Right.
And working with the Adobe Theater for the first time.
For the very first time.
But by the time you hear this, again, if it's years, you may have be the director in residence.
You never know.
So for Conversations with Matthew Bronson here on KUPR 99.9 in the high desert of Placitas, thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Matt.